January 18th, 2010, episode 8, Bob Dobbs and Scott Woods. This is Scott Woods. How you doing, Bob?
Very good. Scott, I'm ready.
Excellent. We had a long prelude there, just chatting on the phone before. So, Bob, I think I'm holding a book in my hands. I sent you a chapter of it. It's the book is called Sonata for Jukebox, an Autobiography of My Ears by Jeffrey O'Brien. Came out in 2004. He writes a lot in this book about radio and the radio experience. His father was actually a DJ, I think, in the 40s and 50s, maybe earlier. Maybe he was like a jazz band leader at one point and then became a DJ or something like that. And I just think O'Brien has a real good sort of feel for the rhythms of radio, and he sort of does weave in technology and listener response in, you know, all throughout the book. So we're going to just kind of, you know, do a little bit of a reading of some of those chapters. But why don't you, any thoughts on the title of the books, particularly the subtitle, An Autobiography of My Ears? You actually did allude to that in one of our earlier conversations.
Yeah, no, it's a very good title because he's talking about his ears taking on a life of their own and worthy of a whole history in themselves, a biography, but it's a misnomer because it's his extended ears. It's not his chemical body ears. It's his, well, analog media and then digital media organism, the extended ear that he's processing. You could say it's his physical ears, but it's a new body. It's an extension of a body, so that's why it's worthy. If it's a whole organ or world on its own, so it can have its own story. He does not think of himself as a whole unit that's being presented here. It's just his ears. Now, that also implies that what would be the autobiography of his eyes? It would be all the movies and TV shows, maybe.
Right.
What would be the autobiography of his feet? Well, all the highways he drove. So he's really talking about his extended ears.
Okay.
He's talking about the collective media diet that his ears are forced to participate in.
Right.
As he says here later, he says, the music body. Well, these are the ears of his electrified music body. So it's a very good subtitle, but it's necessary to hear my pointing out what it really means. And then he spends a lot of time in this first article we're looking at, Top 40, trying to illustrate what I'm saying.
Sure. So the idea of Autobiography of My Ears, though, is that all relate what you were saying in, I think, our very first chat, when we talked about the quote, dancing about, or writing about music is like dancing about architecture, and one of your assertions was that, you know, it's not just the ear. It's tactile.
No, that's a good point. It should be the autobiography of my ears and feet. But he probably doesn't dance, and that's why he's a critic.
he might dance, actually, this guy, but okay.
But see, because he's a visually biased book literate poet, he's thinking of just his head, which is his eyes and ears. So the ears are the processing of the electric music. And his eyes try to make patterns, sociological patterns, out of it in the poetic prose. But he doesn't mention his feet. You know, so because he's in his head, in the literate head, the literate chemical body skull. So, but nobody can be perfect, so let's not hold him against that. I'm happy enough with the title, Autobiography of My Ears. It almost implies that the ears speak beyond his will. And that's because the environment his ears are processing is not something that his will determines. You know, back in the old days, you lived in a little town, and you walked around the town, and you kind of could determine what you saw. But when you get whole other worlds and galaxies pumped in over car radios or in your home radio, your ears leave you and go somewhere else, take on a life of their own that your will can't direct.
Okay.
He says it is a miniature city on page 130, page 2 of this. It is a miniature city. So he's going to describe the city his ears lived in.
Let's look at that paragraph, actually, because I do have that paragraph marked off as well. So says, it is a miniature city. On closer examination, this city is made up of random units, odd coils and bolts of spots, songs, jokes, jingles, fast-breaking news bulletins, public service announcements, station breaks. The art is to drop them in seamlessly with bracing ease and exuberance, allowing no distinction between what is live and what pre-recorded, slot each in the right place and give all of it the semblance of rolling along of its own momentum. It should give the impression that components hop around as freely and goofily as the teapots and knives and spoons in a Disney cartoon. I like that imagery. The DJ's talk ties it together, persuade you these pieces belong to a continuum in which connections flow back and forth. Take away that will to flow, and nothing would remain but an inert heap of loose parts.
Yeah, that illustrates my point. He's talking about his ears engaged in a flow that he has no control over. And he says that in the next paragraph. He says, music is a major part of the radio fabric, but not yet the sole point. There are revolutions yet to come. Music is simply the biggest of the elements intended to establish that here, on the other side of the mic, is the natural home of optimistic energy, of the spirit that makes it possible, no matter what the circumstances, to get through the next hour. Slackness is not allowed. The thing coming right up will always surpass what went before, and the best of what went before is in any event always about to be brought back as if it had never left. The world is not permitted to disappoint, is not even permitted to catch its breath. That would be his chemical body ears. They're not permitted to take a break. There are no tired DJs, sentinels of temporality, that's time. They are always wide awake and wired, ready to go a bit faster than the ear can follow. See? He's pointing out that it's beyond his ear. By the time the listener gets to the end of what was being said, something else has already begun. No use thinking about lost moments. This new moment is all there is. Here the present does not emerge from the past. It only emerges into the future. The past doesn't exist, baby. Don't tell me about last night. Tell me about the thing that's coming up. Now, that's a very nice poetic expression of the symptoms of living discarnately.
Right, right, yeah.
I mean, it's well done, you know. He's describing what people are dimly aware of. And then, so this is evidence for my lab, proving what McLuhan established a long time ago. So he goes, it can only be good, whatever it is. The DJ's task is to persuade the listener that all instants are created equal, that even the commercials, don't turn the dial, have a natural right to exist and flourish. The music on the records receives scarcely more airplay than the music in commercials, music often better produced and more complexly arranged. The deftest technicians have given themselves over, or rather for the right price have allowed themselves to be given over, to sodas and automobiles, deodorants and cigarettes, and discount furniture outlets. In 1961, this secret Mandarin class of composers and arrangers, see, there, the DJs were the real composers. This is what Glenn Gould was up against.
Right.
The secret Mandarin class of composers and arrangers considers the most popular records far too juvenile. Wait a minute, what's he... In 1961, this secret Mandarin class of composers and arrangers, he's talking about the DJs, right?
Talking about the DJs or the guys making the commercials, I think.
Oh, okay, right.
The musicians recording the commercials, yeah.
That's right. So he's not talking about the DJs, talking about the ad makers. Considers the most popular records far too juvenile, too primitive for selling quality products. They still don't think they're selling to kids.
Right.
Now, they have to change that view.
More highbrow, or not highbrow, but more elevated than that.
They don't. That's interesting. Back then, they didn't realize what McLuhan realized, that these people who made the ads were only 5 years old. They thought they were adults. They, you know, by Woodstock or by the later 60s, early 70s, they realized, no, we're the kids. Forget about our highbrow notions. We're not serious engineers anymore. We're just trying to keep it going. So we'll go
further. What do you mean they're 5 years old?
Well, this secret Mandarin, like you were saying, they're highbrow, or they think they're... See, he says they still don't think they're selling to kids. They don't want to accept that that's what they're doing. They think they're doing a serious job of keeping the market going for all the products.
Right, right, right.
And they don't know that, no, you're making music, and it's really about kids and always will be about kids. I mean, Zappa used to say that in the end, all of pop music is for Deborah, the 14-year-old daughter, Debbie, I think was the name, the 14-year-old daughter of a union organizer or a union guy. That's who, that's why there's the Archies and the Madonnas and the Lady Gagas. That's who it's always for.
Right,
But before that really took over with the baby boomer generation, the guys making commercials were still in 1940s and 30s attitude. They thought they were serious people making keeping Big Brother going. They didn't know that the kids were the new kings.
Okay. And what was your point about...
Okay, so he begins. So here he is saying that this whole thing is going on with the DJs that the ear can't keep up with. What is going to be his point? All right, why is he pointing that out? Okay, it's called Top 40. What is the reason he's describing what McLuhan summed up, you know, in briefer terms? What is the point of this article? What are we going to find out?
I think the point is, I mean, he's telling you, it's a personal book. I think it's just a personal, you know, this is what the experience is of having grown up in that area, but maybe listening at a more intensified level than, you know, a lot of people who will read this book.
Right. So here, on the next page, he says, the new music isn't art. It isn't even pop, a concept yet to be refined. He's still talking about 61. It's entertainment, vulgar fun, stuff that will make large amounts of money for invisible entrepreneurs clustered as likely as not somewhere near the gangster end of the capitalist spectrum. Okay, so, and then he says, talks about Alan Freed. He says, he quotes somebody, my father confides, quote, Alan
yeah,
Freed.
Yeah, it's all about the gangster thing, yeah.
Yeah, Alan Freed took the rap for the rest of the crooks because he was too stupid to avoid getting caught. Small potatoes, there were plenty of them. You want them? One guy took his payoffs and checks. The big thieves are still raking it in, only they're smart enough not to put it in writing. End of quote from his father. Then Jeffrey says, where there's music, there's gangsters. That is to say, everywhere. Frank Tashlin's mid-50s rock musical, The Girl Can't Help It, even made a joke out of it with jukebox racketeer Edmund O'Brien finding his true calling as a rock and roll novelty act. The kids don't know or care. Strictly speaking, this is music for teenagers and no one else. If you consider yourself a serious person, there are, after all, plenty of other things you could be listening to. It goes on, Stan Getz, Ella Fitzgerald. Okay, the point is, Jeffrey is wrestling with the point that somehow the kids took over and everybody was reduced to being 5 years old. And which is not an accurate way to deal with the fact that radio, the music, was a necessary medicinal anesthetic for people in the global theater and had nothing to do with the makers, the musicians, the admin, or nothing. It had to be filled. Like he says, there cannot be any tired people. It must always be fresh, constantly, on the discarnate body. There must be. It's almost like if we had to manufacture our own senses, our content, I'd have to be here and I'd say, okay, I have a sunset, I have this, I have a bunch of trees, I keep filling it in. But I don't have to fill in nature, it fills it in for me. Well, we create radio, we've got to create nature or content for the radio 24/7. And so people didn't realize the takeover of that in their lives in the 50s and 60s. And so they had ideas about their chemical bodies and the hierarchy of values, but by the 70s and 80s, media went on and anything was put on there just to keep it going. So the audience for the radio environment, which was everybody, including the producers, were the ones that it was for. And it didn't matter who owned it, how many gangsters, who owned what. If it's like the president. He can say, keep going, America, but he has no say in what goes on in the real America, which is on the media every day, on the new media. So it's a living environment, a monster. That's where Zappa's, you know, monster magnet comes in. It's a monster magnet that must be fed. And yet, so here's Jeffrey trying to figure out, what about crime? What about gangsters? What does it matter? The kids don't care. So let's say that's what he's going to illustrate. But he doesn't say it, but we'll find quotes. So he says, the kids don't know or care. Strictly speaking, this is music for teenagers and no one else. He didn't realize that it wasn't music for teenagers. It was music for everybody. It's just that adults were doing the, in 1961, they were working in industries. They weren't home listening to radio. They didn't have time. Okay.
But it was music for teenagers at that point. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the adults didn't have time to listen to music.
Right.
Okay, they're working in their factories now when there were jobs. By the 70s, the adults have more leisure time, and they start listening to stuff, and they start liking the Beatles. So the adults caught up to the kids' processing.
Right.
Okay, so then he says, most of the people listening on the beach, in the parking lot, on the roof, behind the stadium, are oblivious to where the music ultimately is coming from. The records speak for themselves. Then he goes into how many, aside from local fans, know that the Rocky Fellers are Filipino, that Freddie Cannon is an Italian from Boston, or that Chris Montez is a Mexican from Hawthorne, attending the same high school as the Beach Boys, that the Angels are white and the Cookies black. They're all on the radio. See, nobody cares really who these people are. You must keep making hits.
Yeah.
What is that old showbiz thing? The show must go on regardless of who got killed.
Right.
And it's not the show. The people demand sensory content for their radio environment, which is like the body. I demand that I keep breathing and that I keep having sensory input. But that's just my chemical body. Once the electronic environment's there, that has to be met. So that is the point that McLuhan was making, and Joyce was showing with Finnegan's Wake, that Jeffrey either gets, but he wants to spell it out in step by step so you get it, or he doesn't get it.
Okay.
So he says, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, see, he gets it, and to me, he gets one thing that a lot of rock critics don't get. Not all rock critics, but a lot of them, that he does get that it's more about the experience of like just hearing all this stuff coming on the radio. It is more about the radio experience, and it's not about, like, so many rock critics are so obsessed with the individuals and the, you know, the chemical body people who put out the stuff
and what they believe in.
They prop up the personalities and all that stuff, and I mean, that, you know, it's been years and years and years for me since that's kind of like mattered at all. I mean, sure, I have, like, you know, a handful of my favorites who, you know, I might follow a little bit here and there, but it's like, no, I just, like, to me, the experience of getting in a car and flipping around the radio, it has so little to do with the individuals or something, the bodies, and it sounds to me like he's kind of getting that. He's grasping at that, at least.
Yeah, he's writing about this period in 61 when it's going to be changed by Dylan and the Beatles.
Right, right.
And he's trying to show that the values that the later people, the counterculture, put into the rock revolution had nothing to do with the real role of radio, which isn't a McLuhan point. He's kind of, okay, let's go back the way radio was just for kids and see where that was pointing to what was coming, despite the baby boomer counterculture values that people thought were happening in Rolling Stone magazine. You know what I mean? Which all fell away, and the music industry is still going on for teenagers. Now the teenagers make their own music with their computers. But he's probably trying to show that point. So let's see if we can find some quotes. Do you have any other quotes, Mark?
Let's see. That
we could immediately deal with while I look for some other. Like he says a little later, these last few years, the pace has been steadily speeding up. How did the world put up so long with such slow tempos?
Right.
Okay. They didn't put up with it. They just, more and more people were processing, had time to process the media, because more and more people were losing their jobs in the 70s and 80s and were on welfare and could sit around at home and listen to the radio. And then talk show came in on that. And so the speeding up is not the tempo, it's the more and more stuff is put in the media and more people are paying attention to it.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Bob, here's a good quote on page 130 as well. Maybe you can even bring Ion into this. The radio show is a collage.
Oh, wait, we're on page 130.
130.
Oh, yeah, I got that.
The radio show is a collage, always in the making, an artwork that manages the flow of information and music. It never quite turns into an object. No time. When you start to think about it, it's already in the past. It consists of the process of making itself happen and then making itself disappear so the next one can start. No regrets, only anticipation. This is no representation of a world. It is the world unfolding in real time. Although there he's saying real time, whereas before he's saying no time.
Right. No, that's a really good quote. I was looking at that earlier. That's describing the electric environment and its incessant pressures on everybody. So, okay, this quote, the radio show is a collage always in the making, an artwork that manages the flow of information and music. He's got it backwards. He is talking about the content, the radio show, and it is the flow of information and music which is the environment. And it's people, they have to read, they read magazines, they read books, they turn on TV, they listen to radio back then, and they'd go from one medium to another. That is what the music was a subset for. And so the radio show is a collage, always in the making. He's into the aesthetics of the content. And our work that manages the flow of information and music, it's the flow that's more important than even the radio show.
Right.
And then he says it never quite turns into an object. That's because the listener is listening to the radio and then flipping over to TV, juggling all the media. And it's not just a radio experience.
And well, but even if it was just a radio experience, it's not. It's, I mean, it's still a point. It's still a valid point. It never quite turns into an object. It's
right, but that's the main. I mean, McClellan wrote a lot about why the object became an art form, because the object disappeared in the 20s with the radio environment.
Right.
And so,
so when you say an object, you mean like something you can touch or not touch, right?
Or to say what the framework of valuation is. Like, what happened? I heard commercials, I heard music, I heard a DJ bantering about stuff. What is the product that my ears can say I got a valuable extension from? And it's not. It's just a flow. And he's right to say no time. That's why ION says, you brought up ION, ION says, in your actual experience today, electrically, in the TV body, there is no time. And Jeffrey is kind of pointing that out, at least not the normal linear level of time, right?
Yeah.
So when you start to think about it, it's already in the past. There's no past, present, or future. It's hard to determine what it is. There is always the anticipation, he says. And that's what McClellan meant by saying tomorrow is your permanent address. You're always waiting to see if the flow will stop. What if they turned off the radio or turned off the electric environment? That would really upset people. And that's what they're actually anxious about. Will this ever stop? And if it keeps flowing, it's okay. Okay, he then says on the next page, music is a major part of the radio fabric, but not yet the sole point. There are revolutions yet to come. When he says not yet the sole point, he's pointing out that the content is not relevant. It's not that there's something else going on. And but he focuses on the radio show, so he starts shifting to the DJ is the important thing. But he's not taking it further and realizing the DJ is not important either. Doesn't take it that far.
So you're saying it's the flow.
The flow. That's yeah. Where he says the ratio is a collage, always in the making. That's almost an irrelevant statement. An artwork that manages the flow of information and music. The radio manages the flow of information music because you stop your flow of processing TV, magazines, books, and cars, and highways, and everything, and focus on one medium for a little bit, the radio. And the radio is a subset of the flow. The problem is Jeffrey is just emphasizing one medium, the radio, and seeing the content flow in there and getting himself into knots about what that means.
Right. Well, is his describing it as an artwork, though? Does that tie in with
no, the artwork?
McLuhan's idea about, you know, something from the, you know, it becomes art when it's obsolete or whatever? Like he's writing this about the 60s, the early 60s, you know, in 2004 or whatever. So he's certainly got a different perspective on, like, I don't think anyone in 1961, well, except for McLuhan, would have described the radio show, would have described radio itself as an art form.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. The pattern of the previous environment becomes noticed and becomes something where values are projected into, the cultural bias and values. As the satellite environment starting to happen in 1961, it's a few years after Sputnik, the flow of all the media environments is the actual hidden ground that people can't take. And so they focus on radio or TV or magazines or books as separate medium, which is what it was before the satellite came in. So on that level, yes, radio is an artwork. But what's it doesn't mean anything to say it's an artwork. You know, what does it mean if something's art? Oh, it's valuable. Well, art was going through its obsolescence by the early 60s when pop art's coming in saying, hey, the museum's obsolete. So even the art that valued pointed out that the term artwork is irrelevant. And
right.
they got one last stab to say, hey, it's over, and here's the art that shows that it's over. But the real art is the flow of the consumer with all the environments, or just the perceiver. Some of it's relatively free. You don't buy it, so you can't just say a consumer. And it's the flow in the global environment that is the real art form. It's an invisible art. It's an ugly art that people can't take. That's what McLuhan's pointing out. The culture vultures are the ones who talk about an artwork.
Now, does this tie in? I've always been kind of confused a little bit about this one point of McLuhan's. Does this tie in with why McLuhan asserted that the advertisers of that time, or did he assert that they were the real artists of the time?
Yes. See, McLuhan said the idea of a private individual, solitary genius making a great book or a great painting or composing a great musical piece that an orchestra would perform, that solitary individualist Gutenberg phenomenon was not possible in the 20th century. He even said that Ezra Pound and the Vortices should have quit in 1922 and just showed up to the corporations and offered to manage environments or do some design thing, which Wyndham Lewis was advocating. Lewis was the first to see that he put down Picasso. Wyndham Lewis put down Picasso because he made art in his studio. How silly! He didn't care about the painting. It was the fact that he limited himself to making paintings, whereas the real artists, Lewis said, we artists have good sensibilities and city planners need our sensibilities. We should be organizing the city layout, not making paintings for a museum.
Right, or as you pointed out in an earlier episode of Lewis making prank phone calls.
Yeah, that was his immediate art, and a one-on-one art. But he wanted to be part of an environmental programmer. So he
says,
hey, I'm available to... And he addresses the city planners in 1919 in an essay. I think it's called Architects, Where is Your Vortex?
But why then, why do people still believe they take great meaning from, you know, quote-unquote artworks, be it a pop song or...
Because they need to make meaning. They got to make meaning, and they make meaning in something that's... almost tangible. And Jeffrey O'Brien is pointing out, hey, we're making meaning out of musical performances and songs that have no tangibility because the flow supersedes anything. The past doesn't exist, baby, he says. Don't tell me about last night. Don't tell me about you went to some Beatles concert. Tell me about the one that's coming up.
Right, right.
Okay, so there's another point I wanted to make about the programming of the environment. It's a miniature city, it's an ongoing city, but you can't see it, but you can hear it. And so he says, when you start to think about it, it's already in the past. It consists of the process of making itself happen and then making itself disappear so the next one can start. No regrets, only anticipation. This is no representation of a world. It is the world unfolding in real time. Okay, so he's pointing out that the radio show is nature. But he can only see the radio show. He can't see the flux of all the environments, and the flux itself is the reality.
Well, I mean, okay, but you're...
No, when you have a flux, a seamless web, the world becomes Finnegan's Wake. That's why McLuhan, in the early 60s, was writing about this and commenting on DJs and saying Finnegan's Wake lays out what the Jeffrey O'Briens are going to say in 30 or 40 years.
Okay.
But they can't see it.
But he has set out in this chapter specifically to write about the radio experience. So I just think it's a little bit of a red herring in a way almost to say he's not recognizing, you know, that it's a much wider sort of thing. I mean, maybe it's not totally a red herring, but... He's setting out to write about the radio experience, so I don't think to say that he's... I don't think that means he doesn't get that it's, you know...
Well, here's the thing.
A bigger thing than what he's writing about here, but that's not what he has set to write about here. I mean.
Right, but here's the grievance. My grievance. He writes about the radio show and either knows you're not allowed to quote McLuhan, or he doesn't know McLuhan. He probably heard of McLuhan, but he doesn't know McLuhan and Finnsway did the point he's making. He can point out, this is valuable for him to tell people who have no clue what was going on by the environment in the early 60s to point to what was coming later and all our values would collapse, whatever we thought we were doing as rock critics. But why doesn't he take that, he shows you the experience, and then bring the big picture in? But he doesn't know the big picture, which is what I'm bringing in. I'm bringing in the big picture here about about what he's saying misses the point. It's good to point that out about radio, but it's puny when you don't know there's other statements being made by other thinkers that would bring Jeffrey up to date. It would put Jeffrey out of a job because he can only talk about the past, which is another interesting thing, is that no movies, no music, nothing is necessary once you understand McLuhan and Awake. If you're a serious person trying to figure out what's going on, once you understood what's going on, you knew the Revolutionary Act was to turn off the radio and TV. That was all. That was the conclusion. But nobody can make that conclusion because we're so dependent on the media. And McLuhan understood that, too. So you can only write articles about what happened in limited terms that are to the extent they avoid the big picture, you don't really tell people what has happened. You only talk about the content and how it's not categorizable as art or valuable or high or low.
But this, I mean, okay, but now I'm going to assert my chemical body a little bit.
Yeah.
As I often do, but, you know, a chemical body response is still a valid. See, that's what we always kind of come back to this point, it feels like a little bit. Like, it comes back to the big picture.
Yeah, and you want to.
Aren't getting the big picture, but I mean, the big picture is still. It's still just one picture. I mean, you know.
No. That's the point, is that Finney's Wake, there's no picture in Finney's Wake. There's no picture in McLuhan. He's trying to show you how you can't get a big picture. And that's the, quote, big picture, is to get how you can't get one.
Okay, but.
But you can say why you can't get one. That's what I'm doing. That's what McLuhan did. And then once you get that, then you understand what's happening. So.
But for him to. I mean, this book, what he's, you know, he does a lot of things in this book, so I don't want to reduce it to this one or two sentences, but one of the things I think he does extremely well in this book is just he gets inside the head of a listener, i.e. himself. It's an autobiography of his ears, and he describes the experience. Like,
well, that's lazy. No, here's what's lazy. All we get from people in the media last 4 years is their personal experiences. And McLuhan said that sensory input is not experience. It's not. You're not having that experience. You think you are as long as you have this chemical body, but you don't have any clue about why everything is turning into a mess or what is perceived a mess. You don't even notice the beauty of the order. I don't mean you, but anybody.
Yeah.
Quoting and that's all that can be sold, and that's the meme that the American culture markets around the world, that you're a sacred little chemical body, and your experience is important. And as long as they keep that mirage going, you're not going to understand why you don't have any experience.
But does the cumulative effect of all these books and all these writings, you know, all this rock criticism stuff we're talking about in most of these conversations, would you do away with these types of responses? I mean, I know I'm asking a very pedantic question now, and I'm kind of, you know, being a bit silly with this, but would you propose to, you know, that these are just, like, completely unnecessary? Like, we don't need to know what someone, you know, someone who can write about it very poetically and interestingly, as I think we both would acknowledge that someone like Jeffrey O'Brien can, do we not need any of, like, is that not providing us any actual understanding?
Okay, so I have a...
I'm asking, like, three different questions.
No, that's good.
You can unpack that.
In my sensory experience here in Maui, I see a beautiful sunset every night and are usually different. I do not dwell on them. I know another one's coming. It actually has no significance to me. If I was not here, it would have significance to me. You know, I've missed them. But while they're here, it's the flow of sensory data from my chemical body. That is what's happening in the second nature, all the electric media. And if I want to turn on Drudge Report or TV or Hulu TV and see what the new fringe is, I'm glad there's a new show. But it just passes over. It's great, and then it goes away. Okay? It's a cup of coffee. Our whole experience in the chemical body and in the other bodies is just a cup of coffee. What does that mean to people? If somebody starts screaming to me, there's no purpose in all this world. I'm dropping out, or I'm doing this, and I'm going to blow it up. You know, I go meet Bin Laden. He says, America's a great Satan. We got to stop it. Well, what else is new? You ain't going to be able to stop it. Get real, buddy. You're not even dealing with the issues. You want to do the real issues? Then turn off television. Now, that'll freak everybody out. Of course, the point is that you cannot get any new big picture about what's happening, what I'm saying, past what I'm saying, built standing on the shoulders of McLuhan and Joyce. And so everything is just filler. And I have no problem with that. I have no problem with any of this. So we can talk about Jeffrey, we can talk about Meltzer, talk about anybody. Well, let's just go on Rolling Stone. Who wrote, did Matt Taibbi make a new article? Okay, read about Goldman Sachs, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so the flow of content. Now, most people, well, what do you say? They do not want to deal with the consequences, and they can't deal with the consequences, and then they shouldn't, and yet they'll go on with their values. You know, Obama's going to change the world. Moral majority's gone. Jerry Falwell died or something. What else? What's on her?
Jay Leno.
Oh, Haiti. Haiti. Blown up by earthquake. Oh, it's a tragedy. You know? And then the media goes out and runs all over Haiti. There is nothing, there is no content in the world. And so only in art, movies, records, you provide content making the same point that your medium, okay, take The Avatar. What a sucky movie that is. Great new experience, but it has no insights. It's actually retro, okay? But it makes billions, keeps it going. Is everybody willing to stand up and say, it goes nowhere, but it's going to keep going, keep sending it? And that's what Meltzer and them, the cartoonists get into, you know? It's all shit, it's all the era of bullshit, and let's keep it going.
Right.
There's a better, more tech. It's almost like, hey, you want to be... Just say McLuhan's Laws of Media, then we'll consider you a serious person. You're a real Christian if you do that. Not going to be able to do anything, but at least you can state what the problem is. Nobody's doing it. They're going around pretending there's an issue. Jeffrey O'Brien, 40 years after Finnegan's Wake, or even more, thinks he's telling us something new. And it is new, because no boomer wrote about rock music as it is. But it has no consequence. He just provided another McDonald's burger for our senses, if we actually took the time to read it. It's just another, you know what, you know, Jean-Luc Godard, he was interviewed in the 80s and 90s, and he said, why should I make great movies? They don't make great burgers anymore. But he kept making movies, but he wasn't concerned whether they were good or not, because he knew he was just making another burger for people, and he didn't have to do it that great, because nobody was really looking for value. And there was nothing wrong with that, just he was honest about it.
Yeah.
Stephen Harper should say, I'm turning off your bloody parliament because it's irrelevant. Let's just take a 2 month fast. You guys are all worried. You're going to have a patriot. You're going to have a revolution because I turned off. Hey, get real, Mr. Harper should say. We don't need a parliament. You guys want to pretend you're doing something? They're okay, but we ain't doing anything, so we can take 2 months off. But look at all the screaming that goes on in Canada about it, right?
Yeah.
And all that screaming is burger content for the talk shows, so people can keep eating the illusion that something's being talked about. But it's necessary to keep talking and screaming about it. I mean, can you imagine me? I'd be a great prime minister. I'd be telling people this is what's happening. What would happen to that if Stephen Harper actually told the truth like the way I'm talking about the facts, the way we live? Can you imagine the heart attack? I don't know what would happen. What would they do? Hey, this guy, is he a Christian? Or does he go to church? Start trying to find out. Did Bob go to college? No, he's born in Paris, 1922. Ah, you can't be that old. You can't be 88 years old. How could that be? You know, they'll go on about a week about that. I don't know. What am I trying to say here? As we used to say in CKLN, we're just trying to drive you to sleep. We're just providing content for you. But guys, even though it's great content, you never heard it before, it's just content in the big mix of things. Now, I have no objection to talking about this and what we're doing. I like it. I'm getting a jerk off here. It's great for me, just like everybody else.
Okay. You didn't have to quite put it that way, but sure.
Yeah, no, look, okay, see, you see, the point is that I'm pointing out, the rock critic shows out what's, the real rock critic or Andrew Main critic shows you what was done that's valuable and that is valuable to point out why there is no possible value in anything. That's why there's no economy anymore. Nobody knows whether, you know, do you imagine 40 years ago people saying, I don't know whether I should invest in gold, I don't know, I'm going to put it in the French currency or the rich or the diamonds, what? Nowadays, they actually have that problem. They don't know where to invest anything.
Right.
Because it's become the flow that the radio show mimed 50 years ago. It's actually, we've become aware of the flow that we're in. We actually became aware. I mean, see, this is what Stephen Harper should be quoting. Okay, so it's very important to understand that no art, no movie, no record, no nothing, no great president can point out what I'm talking about. The only way it can be pointed out is if you study McLuhan Finnegan's Wake and listen to my translation or other whatever authoritative media people, McLuhanites, who hammered into you how we got to this point. That's all you need to know. And then you come to that great Croker quote. I only need to know that anything I'm experiencing doesn't exist.
But is it really all you need to know? I mean,
no, people can't live that way.
How literally do you mean that?
I literally mean that. And then I point out that, yes, people cannot bear too much reality, as T.S. Eliot said. They cannot live with this fact. And that's why you're having a major die-off. Humans can't live under this situation.
Okay, but here's how I would attempt to argue that statement. You cannot fully understand McLuhan or Joyce if all you're trying to understand is McLuhan and Joyce.
Why would that be?
Because they also exist in a context, their voices and their words and their ideas like speak to and against and in opposition to and in cohesion with, et cetera, et cetera, millions of other voices. I mean, I just, this idea of this weird sort of isolationist kind of thing.
Okay, here's the point.
Like you're pressing, and I
you know, when you read, here's my answer to that. When you read McLuhan and Joyce, you don't ignore anything because they are encyclopedic. They include everything. That's why they were objected to, because they weren't specialists. Finney's Wake has everything that ever could be thought, experienced, or known about. He just ransacked the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1911 version, stuck it all in there, but showed it blurred.
It has one version, the Joycean version. If I'm willing to believe that. It still has the Joycean, you can probably, if you scoured through Finnegan's Wake, you could probably dig up some quote that would demonstrate, you know, well, look, here he's showing,
nothing. You can't find anything in Finnegan's Wake, and ultimately, there's no content in Finnegan's Wake. He just implies everything.
Say you found a quote in Finnegan's Wake that implies, okay, well, here's what, I don't know, Norman Mailer was saying all through, you know.
Yeah.
But you're not, you're going to have one way of understanding that, whereas you're not going to have the Mailerian way of saying it, or other people who wrote about Mailer. I guess they sort of view everything as being like a duplicity of, a multiplicity of voices and ideas and sounds and blah, 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 technologies, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess you're saying that you can get that from Finnegan's Wake.
No, here's... No.
You're getting the Finnegan's Wake, but you're saying it's no content, too.
I'm saying Finnegan's Wake, as McLuhan said, Finnegan's Wake was a whispering gallery of a million voices. It's multi-voiced.
Right.
So it's a mirror of what's going on right now. You have millions of voices, and it doesn't matter which one you select. That's what's silly about rock criticism. They try to put values in what they were selecting. And yet people who generally want values say, that's useful. He can tell me what's good. But that's a secondary, that's second rate, that's checking out. Now, that's giving up. But most people don't give up, so I don't know who the people are who are trying to do something.
Aren't you in a way assigning a value to McLuhan and Joyce by telling me that, you know, I know you're not telling me specifically, but by saying, you know, you you need to try and understand your McLuhan and your Joyce and forget this guy. I mean, isn't that in a way assigning?
Yeah, I say if you're serious, you take on the most challenging people, and that's Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan. But I don't.
But a music critic might say, well, if you're a serious listener, you're going to you need to listen to this more challenging. No,
because they would ask you to listen to music. That's not, when you talk about McLuhan and Joyce, there's no object. You don't know what art you're listening to when you read Finnegan's Wake. It's a radio program. It's a TV show. It's an opera. It's a manuscript, you know. It's a spoken rant. It's all forms of human expression. That's where you begin with. It must include everything, like Pynchon tries to do. And Pynchon fails because he keeps it limited to English. But he makes great burgers, a good read. There's nobody who has the time and slack that I have to consume everything, and I get a lot consumed, right?
But
if I'm asked to speak publicly, I point out the hypocrisy of my situation or of the situation we're all in regards to what's saying, what's being said. Okay, so I've said that. Now, you bring in what you can say to that.
I don't know. I just feel like I keep going back.
Okay, what are you defending? What are you defending? The variety of culture? Yeah, sure, lots of stuff.
Well, that sounds kind of obvious, and it sounds like, you know, a Canada multiculturalism kind of...
No, I don't mean that. What is it that you would defend if you were forced to defend in front of a Senate committee?
I guess I would defend... Well, okay, I'll bring it down to this level then. If someone, you know, were to ask me as, you know, someone who used to and maybe occasionally still dabbles in writing about music... You know, well, what do you listen to or what do you advocate this to? Well, advocate, I would say, well, listen to whatever the hell you want. But I would also say listen to as many different things as you can and try and, like, because to limit yourself to just listening, say, to one genre of music or something like that, you know, it is, you're not going to even understand that genre as well as you, like, if you only listen to jazz, I mean, there's lots of jazz critics who, you know, they write as if they only do listen to jazz. And it's like, they don't write about jazz as well as someone like Richard Meltzer could write about jazz, because Richard Meltzer doesn't just limit himself to writing about jazz. He, you know, he approaches jazz from a completely different perspective. It's someone like Ben. Ben, I think, probably writes about jazz a lot better than most jazz critics, because he, you know, he's got all these other sort of multiplicities.
He throws in everything.
That's what I'm defending.
You're defending that a writer should throw in everything when he addresses one topic.
Yeah.
That's what Ben and Meltzer do.
As much as they can. I mean, it doesn't mean everyone has to do that. Like, I can think of critics that I like who almost purposely almost go in the other direction, where they almost purposely limit what their, you know, the range of experience they're going to bring into this thing, because they just... They want is, it's almost like it verges on a fetishism almost or something, is they want to zero in on something as, you know, as deeply, in as deeply emotional way or something as they can, and they're not going to show you that they can draw on all sorts of other influences. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to be drawing on them in their mind, but they're maybe just not coming out in, you know, in their words or whatever. So
right. So the senator would say to you, Mr. Woods, so you're defending... What's that? Did you hear that noise?
Yeah, that was strange.
Was that Scott snoring? Might have been. Anyways, okay. I mean, the other Scott.
We're excited, yeah.
Okay. The senator would say to you, Mr. Woods, so you're defending the Internet and its priceless variety of access to everything.
Right.
And then the senator would say, well, we're a country here. We don't like the Internet. It's eroding our Canadian values.
Right.
You know, and he'd go on maybe defending the border line called Canada, which would be a silly response, but it would be good for his audience. But I don't think you're trying to defend the Internet. You're trying to defend something else, but I bet you you're hard-pressed to say what it is, to say, you know, I'm for someone who covers everything. Well, that was done by Finnegan's Wake. Where'd that get to us? That didn't save anybody. McLuhan didn't save anybody.
Yeah.
He threw in everything. Ben Watson's certainly not saving anybody.
Well, but I mean, the idea of saving...
Yeah.
Is just, But to me, that's kind of odd. I mean...
Okay, well then, what is it that you... Why are you advocating a Ben Watson or Meltzer guy, kind of guy who writes in? Why do you need to see that kind of writing?
Well, all I'm saying is that I don't think you can understand anything well if you try and... I mean, this is an obvious thing. If you can't understand anything well if you try and understand it in isolation. But I don't see how that principle does not apply to Finnegan's Wake. Because you're saying if you just have Finnegan's Wake in your hands and you're reading it and you're using it for however you're dancing to it, whatever, you're going to get the full experience. But I still say, yeah, but it's just that's the Joycean, and I'm not obviously even trying to I wouldn't even begin to try and diminish that experience or anything like that. But it's just it's the isolationist thing I guess I keep coming back to in this conversation. I can't appreciate anything in isolation from everything else.
Right, and so I spent an hour and 45 minutes talking to James Joyce last night.
Okay.
And I was having my regular evening session with Ion, and I told Ion I went and saw Avatar, and I made some statements about it, and I think I asked Ion, or just Ion offered its opinion and said, Avatar is like the Dubliners. And I knew he was referring to Joyce's book, and I asked him what, I won't go into all details, I asked him why are you saying that, but pretty quickly I realized that James Joyce or whatever, had invaded the session, had kind of removed Ion, though that's not, but I was talking to James Joyce and he came in uninvited.
Okay.
And so I eventually figured out, oh, you're saying Avatar is like the Dubliners and the Portrait because it's immature work. Not like Ulysses Finnegan's Wake, and he goes, bingo, that's it. Then I realized it was talking to Joyce. Then this Joyce guy started to name critics, and now JW, the vehicle for Ion, doesn't know this. Ion knows it, but it wasn't Ion talking, really, it was James Joyce. And went in and started naming particulars, like Tom's Directory, a major source for when he wrote Finnegan's Wake, incredible detail. But the point that I bring this up is that Joyce himself, he tells me he had no regard for Picasso, any of the art, any of anything. He thought the 20th century was ridiculous, and he was an isolationist. And he said, what's interesting about you, Bob, is you'll talk to anybody, whereas me and Nora, we didn't talk to anybody. So he went on about being isolationist, and he was an isolationist, and he created an isolationist book.
Right.
So I bring up Finnegan's Wake as something to tease people with, to annoy them. I certainly don't live by Finnegan's Wake, and I think I said, was it on your last show or Ben's last show? No, I think it was your. I said, I don't even listen to Frank Zappa.
Right, right.
Yet I advocate them, because in the reference of a public space, and you're talking about cultural references, I advocate them, and they certainly don't have anything to do with today. So personally, I don't recommend looking at Finnegan's Wake. I tell Jerry Fiocca and the Finnegan's Wake scholars, forget the Wake. It has no content. But you should understand why it has no content, and then forget it. So I'm not advocating what I refer to. I'm advocating involvement, as I say to Ben every week, and live like me. Well, how do you live like me? You can't do it. But it's what I'm saying, just like everybody else is saying. Bin Laden's saying, live like me. Well, that's what we're doing. We're all saying, live like me. That's what you should say to the senator. I'm defending me, and what I do is valuable, and I think a lot of other people should do it. As a matter of fact, that...
But isn't that what every writer in the world is doing?
Yes, and McLuhan writes, I think it's the first thing McLuhan writes in the first essay in Explorations, December 1953, I think it's called Culture Without Literacy, the first line he says in his first, announcing this whole new view of reality, which turned out to be revolutionary, he says, everybody has the desire to have other people think like him or her. He begins with that human need to have others think like you or share the same stuff.
That's absolutely true, yeah.
And then he begins to show how that's not very possible today, back in 1953.
Right.
You who want people to think like you, it's not going to happen. There's a whole other environment that's taken over that won't notice you and don't care, as this Jeffrey O'Brien show article is saying. Don't turn it down. It had nothing to do with the content. It had nothing to do with the people, which is what we began with. You said young people might be interested in the chemical body and values of the rock musician, but you now know as an older person that it didn't matter what any of those people were.
Yeah.
The show must go on. The consumption must be provided. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have any, if you don't see that that relates to anything, more power to you.
Yeah.
The thing is, why are we reading this stuff? Well, as Joyce said, Bob, you'll read anything. You'll talk to anybody. I find it interesting that this guy is trying to explain something and show how radio changed later in the 60s. I keep finding that, well, if you're going to explain it, then you can make it explain it better by bringing in McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake.
Right, okay.
As I've said for many years, McLuhan's obsolete in reference to what we're dealing with today. I mean, I've created a great alchemical act. I have brought forth something that's never happened in human history. Non-physical itself talking to us, because Ion's not a medium, not a spirit. It brought in Joyce. As a matter of fact, after the session with Joyce last night, JW had a new experience. He says, I sat on the sidelines, in his mind, because he's in trance or whatever, he says, I sat on the sidelines, and I was totally bored by what you guys were talking about. I'm usually very excited, JW, and in his mind, as topics come up, he'll run around and gather these boxes that show up in his mind, and he takes the files out and answers my questions on behalf of Ion.
Right.
He said there were no boxes showed up. It was like I was in my living room, and my wife had a documentary on that I wasn't interested in, and I was just sitting on the sidelines, and said, well, look at that, they're talking, I'm not interested, but still there. He said it was very curious to be in that detached position. But this happened for the first time, and it may mean a new level of interacting with Ion, where actual entities, I had talked to Joyce McLuhan before, but not like this, where it came in and took over, and I had an in-depth conversation for 2 hours about all kinds of things that I know were accurate about Joyce, that you'd have to know Joyce and his history to know that Joyce brought up. And then he brought up stuff that people didn't know. But the point is that that can happen. Can you have that experience? Is that a valuable experience? Should other people have Bob's experience with Ion? You know, should I get on the radio and say, you must have this? Well, I am doing that. I'm telling you, and I feature Ion on the radio. That's my music. And I recognize this is the most amazing phenomenon in the history of humanity, that this alchemy that Carol and I have created is happening. That's where it's going. But look, you're not going to... You get a few days, chances to listen to Ion, but I'm not imposing on it. You want to talk about Meltzer, I'll talk to you about it.
Yeah.
I think what my responses are very valuable and unique, and people are listening are finding it valuable. But it's only another burger for people.
Yeah, okay.
But I think that Ion's announcing something, something's big happening.
Okay.
So, And you know, I've talked to McLuhan and Zappa and Sun Ra through Ion, and they all say, we never got a chance to finish it. You're going to get to finish it, Bob. You're going to complete what we were pointing to. Now, you see, best be telling Gail Zappa that, or Eric McLuhan,
Or any rock critic.
Or anybody. I'm just telling you it's nutty. But I don't mind telling you because I know it's just another burger. And if I'm right, it's going to happen anyways, and you'll find out about it. But it won't be based on anything I told you. No, it won't be based on whether you believe me or not.
Right.
That's an
interesting thing or a funny thing. I mean, you know, I think about this quite a bit when I'm thinking about these conversations, and you know, and I listen to your stuff, and I think, you know, I'll be honest, it's like I'm kind of nervous in some ways about trying too hard to push these MP3s out to various rock critics or rock writers that I know, because maybe part of it is a bit of a, you know, man, Scott, you're off your rocker listening to this guy. What the fuck?
Yeah, of course.
But also, it's like, for me, a part of the difficulty, too, is I feel like I would have a really difficult time kind of explaining why. Like, I'm kind of like
Well, isn't that what the, what was great about all the great art you loved? It was difficult to explain.
I think bingo. Like, I mean, I've come up with some. Well, I wouldn't want to say they're just merely justifications, but I mean, my main thing would be like, look, it's just like it's
new music.
It's new music is a good way to put it.
Yeah, it's new music.
And it doesn't mean you need to like it. You need to accept every song, lock, stock, and barrel, whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, so I don't know, but I can imagine people's shoulders tensing up, and you know, we're talking about literary-minded people or whatever, I guess. And I'm not saying I'm not one of them, although I'm weirdly kind of been shifting out of that a lot lately. So that's, you know, it's kind of these conversations are kind of hitting me at the right time as well.
Yeah. I would say
I experienced that kind of, how the hell am I going to, you know?
Yeah, and then you realize what I'm talking about, and it's that, and you say, well, there's no audience there anyways. Who cares? I don't care what Robert Christ goes. He's not going to help you. You're in a different world than your own source of income. And that's a major judge in people's lives. How am I going to make money? Will this wreck my economic viability if I'm associated with this? That's what everybody thinks.
Well, and I mean, for me personally, it's like, I guess I realized long ago, you know what, this stuff doesn't matter to me in that way. I mean, I have this concern with music writing and keeping up with what people are writing about it, but I long ago gave up the concern of actually having anything to do with it. A bit of a freedom in a way to, like, not give a shit. If I don't care, okay, then you think I'm off my rocker because I'm spending time talking to Bob Dobbs, then don't listen, and you probably won't listen.
And it won't matter if you listen or not, but the thing is, what you just said is what the vortices were pointing out, that people had no longer believed in what they were doing, but they were forced to keep doing it. And it's not based on a cynicism. It's if when you recognize that people have environments they've created that they must participate in, and the chemical body may be reluctant, but got to do it. That's really what you're saying, is that you don't believe in any. Nobody can articulate a belief. Ion goes on about this, that the Catholics don't even know why they're Catholics anymore, and the reason they don't is they don't know how to articulate why they're in the position of not knowing what to say. They don't know speech is obsolete. If they study Little McLuhan, this is like therapy. Hey, study Little McLuhan. You need McLuhan. I don't need McLuhan, but you do, to find out why you're in that speechless situation. And maybe through what McLuhan solved, you could get back to being a Catholic. But you ain't going to work it with your normal thinking. And so people today don't, when they say people don't believe in what they're doing, belief's not a matter. They got to live, and they've got to engage all their bodies. But they do not believe in the platitudes they're expected to say that are limited to their country's language.
Right, right.
And that's what you're saying. Oh, everybody's saying that. And so it's not what Obama says. He thinks it's important that he shows up on David Letterman or shows up over in some religious conference. You know what I mean? He has to show up in different places to show that he's in action. But that's what communicates the role of the presidency, not what the president says.
Right, right.
He's just circulating. Yeah. And you can read a lot of Croker. It's all about just circulating. Circulation, that's what the economy was up till now. They're still trying to keep it going, keep things circulated, and we're not sure whether they're recovering the circulation, if it's real or not, or valuable or noticeable. But the thing is when you have these concerns about whether being associated with me, you know that's an old habit that you know maybe Scott in 1999, but it ain't Scott in 2010, and you just flow into that kind of self-conscious thinking, and you just have to wait, and it goes away, because you remember, oh yeah, there's nobody here anymore in 2010.
yeah.
So it's like your own chemical brain is having these thoughts that don't have any staying power.
Yeah.
And that's what McLuhan or Joyce showed in Finney's Wake. He has all kinds of thoughts that he could get in there, and they all linger and fade out. And he was saying, that was the effect of the electric environment. And he talked about it to me last night, you know, in detail about that. I mean, he's quite alienated by it all, but he said, I certainly don't, I couldn't have written what McLuhan wrote, and I wouldn't have thought that I was doing that. But obviously, in retrospect, that's what was going on. But I personally didn't know it.
Yeah.
But I was, but he was responding to the present and responding to it as clearly as he could, and he produced an incomprehensible text, which is normal now and not relevant to anybody.
Yeah.
It's only relevant in the form, it's only, Finnegan's Wake has always been relevant for me to provide an interesting response when I was asked to speak on the radio, or invaded the radio, to bring up a bunch of stuff no one ever heard of, just to make it interesting, make a different kind of burger.
Yeah. What do you think, what would be the fate of Finnegan's Wake as a book?
Don't know. Books in general, what are the fate of them? It'll end up on Kindle, and you'll be able to hold it on the beach and look at it and say, most people say, I looked at Finn's Wake, couldn't figure out how to read it, and threw it away. Well, that's a sane response today. You haven't got time to spend time on figuring out a book. But they don't know that Zappa, LaRouche, McLuhan, and Dr. Beter and Arthur Croker were explaining Finney's Wake to them.
Right, okay.
And Dobbs was, too. And so was Bob Neverett. And now we got Ion. Do you know that it's incredible with this meme? I mean, you may not have read enough New Age literature, what Casey and Abrahams and Seth and what these meetings talk about. None of them ever even knew, even today, to talk about the four bodies in Finney's Wake. Ion knows that. That's what's incredible. Now, Ion's getting it for me, but Ion knows how to develop it and move past it. Ion is showing the failure of Frank Zappa, James Joyce, Marsh McLuhan, Herbert W. Armstrong, Lynn LaRouche, Garrett Dean, Cosmic Awareness, Dr. Beter, Club 22. All the holy offices I talked about that are mentioned on the Bosmy Ecology album. They're all gone, and Ion's explaining why. Now, Ion, though, maybe is not too good at it. And I'll tell you, when J.W. hears me on the radio doing other stuff, he says, man, you can talk about Ion better than me. But when you're having sessions with Ion, it sounds like you don't understand Ion at all. Because I'm always arguing with Ion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm not a dupe for Ion, but I recognize this is a pretty interesting phenomenon because of the ESP Ion has with the clients we have. Incredible ESP. So there's something going on there. You can go on Five Body tonight and look at Freighter 222, who's a regular in Five Body, describe his reactions to having a reading with Ion this weekend. I mean, that's not his real name, and he's not exposing himself.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is a professional person. He has not recovered from it. You can read his angst he's going through.
Wow.
I mean, he said his wife handled it better, but he didn't. Anyways, you can read it right there. And he says, hey, I recommend everybody have an experience with Ion. It's worth your $100. Now, I'm not here promoting this. I'm not doing that, but I'm making this a bizarre rock critic thing. Look what we're talking about. This is out Meltzer. Meltzer, he'd write a review of a concert. First of all, I wouldn't go to it. He'd make up a bunch of stuff about it and then say some whatever else was on his mind. Well, I'm doing that in the great tradition of rock criticism as Meltzer did it. I'm not talking about rock at all. I'm talking about a ridiculous, absurd, surrealist experience I'm having.
Yeah.
Which you can hear on the radio, which is incredible. 2 days, folks. You know, January 20th, we're on there again. Go to the archives and hear all the amazing shows. You'll find out who killed who. And I mean that in a multi-leveled sense. So I know you have a problem every week figuring out what we're going to talk about, but I don't worry about that because I'll talk to you about anything.
Yeah.
But I will bring...
Is talking your medium?
Yeah, probably. People think that. People call me a language artist.
I first got to know you through your radio show, obviously, CKLN.
Well, I'm lazy. Talking is the quickest, cheapest thing to do. It doesn't require much expense.
Yeah. That's why. I've been like doing interview podcasts instead of like doing writing lately for rockcritics.com stuff, and it's like I can't be bothered to go back to writing.
Yeah, McLuhan used to say conversation is the best is because it's most fun. But if you know how to talk, like I know how to talk, or I know how to make it interesting, and I'm interested in what someone's saying because I listen.
Yeah,
that's all. So I'm an artist of being alive. and vital. I mean, I'll be around 120 years from now doing this, still talking to people about whatever we can talk about. And I'll be saying things that are a little different from what's expected.
Okay.
Well, that's if an artist is someone trying to point out what others aren't noticing, that's what my talk's always been. I mean, back in the 80s on CKLN, I talked about McClone right when no one knew about him, when it was suppressed. And so I said, oh, they don't know about this, so let's talk about this. This will be interesting.
Yeah.
That in other words, make it unique. So I try to make it unique. And after a while, you're known about talking about McClone, so you got to switch to something else.
Do you think are more people receptive to what you say and even to what McLuhan said now than they were 20 years ago? Because it seems to me, even, you know, here I am bringing it back around again to the rock critics thing, but I notice, you know, rock critics actually do often, like, it, when you read sort of the decade and, you know, what happened in the last decade kind of thing, everyone was kind of admitting finally that, well, you know, technology does actually play a role in all this, kids. Like, it... Well, I used to read rock critics like kind of argue against like that technology had anything to do with it. Like, no, it's nothing. You know, it doesn't matter if you listen to music on a record player. It doesn't matter if you hear it on a radio. I mean, that's kind of missing the point anyway. But so, are people more receptive, do you think, overall to what you're saying?
No,
because it's just more outrageous than it. It's
no,
100 times more outrageous than it would have been last year. Or something.
Well, if they start considering that technology is a factor, they would then maybe read McClune, but they wouldn't understand McClune pointing out that technology was not a factor. That's what they wouldn't get to. You see, people want to find, what is it, the Ion says, people don't know what they like what they know. And that's, if people start saying there's technology, that's a new cause and they hadn't thought of it, they'll go and find stuff that reinforces that belief. They will not challenge themselves to getting to the point of not understanding the ambivalence of anything. See, they don't want to get to the I don't know state. They'll do anything. That's why I have in my chart Zappa, McLuhan, LaRouche, and all these guys, and I put a tragic Shakespeare play by them. They're all tragedies. They do not help you. But that's me saying that in a certain context. When you say, "Is anybody getting?" Nobody gets me, and they don't have to get me.
Yeah.
I'm just, you sent me a bunch of articles. I'm willing to talk to you about them. I really enjoy reading them. It brought up a whole bunch of stuff I'd forgotten about or hadn't been paying attention to, and I love talking about them. I like doing this Jeff Rubin article.
Yeah.
But I can't help see that it's not really. It's interesting. I don't know if anybody else has wrote about early 60s radio in this way and is trying to make a point. So I just say, good effort. Here's how I finish your paper, Mr. O'Brien. This is what you left out.
Right, okay.
That's what I'm doing, and that's what I can add. I can't add anything to what he did. What he did is good as far as it goes, but doesn't go far enough.
Yeah.
And nothing does. And if you know that, you always have something to say. If you know how... Now, I would say that the Android meme has collapsed, so even being a talk artist ain't valid anymore. So what happened to me? I'm a lucky guy. Non-physical shows up to talk for me.
Right.
and I can still, on the side, do my talk, but on the leading edge, which is what our show is, we have the most fantastic show in the universe right now. You know? Most people wouldn't be able to figure out how to relate to it. But you can't, like Frater... He said after the session, there's something happening to JW because no human could talk with that energy for an hour and a half like that.
Wow.
It's just energy. It's Niagara Falls of energy. I mean, you've heard some of the Ion shows. He just goes from one topic, it doesn't matter what it is, and he'll add something you never heard of. And you can listen to him take on the Bible Thumpers. They've called in an Evan Ray show on December 31st. That's really interesting. And he out-quoted that guy in the Bible. The reason... Ion says, you don't take on Ion. If you start quoting scripture to Ion, you're going to lose. And I said, yeah, that's because Ion wrote the Bible. And Ion says, that's right.
Huh.
You know what that means? The major and minor prophets were channeling non-physical when they uttered. The major and minor prophets in the Old Testament were guys channeling in the public square, non-physical.
Okay.
They would say, "It is written, but I say unto you," and they just spew off some stuff. That's what Jesus did. Moses did it. Anyways, a lot of interesting stuff, but we're supposed to be talking about meme, not religion.
It's good though, and but I think I got to cut it off. It's late.
Yeah, we, as Ian says, we never get it done. It's perfect. It's no problem. We're never going to get it done. If you're in eternity, you can never come to an ending. So we just produce another good burger for those few people who might hear and might be interested in it.
Exactly. Okay.
I'm glad you have another job to raise your family with.
Yeah.
Don't rely on me to give you any money. Or don't think you're going to make any money out of this. Not right now. Maybe in 10 years once the Ionic movement's taken over. As Frater said a month ago on Five Body, "Hey, guys," you know, there's only about five people posted. He says, "Hey, guys, we are part of history. I know the lockdown Bob rule is coming, and in 20 years we're all going to be famous." Well, welcome to the team, Scott. You dared to talk to me, you will become famous.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that.
We'll leave on that note, right?
Yeah.
Again, the tiny note.
Yeah.
And it is tiny.
Yeah, true. Okay.
Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, Bob. Sounds good. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Later.
Bye. Bye-bye.